two presentations today. We'd like to get started, and although we're a couple members short, now we're only one member short, we'll go ahead with the presentation. First of all, it's called the meeting of resources together here at 108. And please acknowledge, Madam Secretary, that present are Representatives Shula, Kapsner, Stevens, Chenault, Green, McGuire, Bates, Matzik, and Scalzi. And also in the audience, we have Representative Davies sitting in, too. So I'd like to... Oh, did I miss Fred? I'm sorry. There he is. Representative Dyson's back there also. I'd like to point out we have two presentations today, the first of which is Professor Gunter Weller out of the University of Alaska Fairbanks and the Center for Global Change, International Arctic Research Center. He's going to give us a presentation on the effects of global warming and what it will mean for the state of Alaska, particularly in developing our resources, whether it be oil and gas, fisheries, mining. It pertains to everything that we do here in the state regarding resources. The second half, we're going to try and cut it up in two parts. We've got a presentation from Richard Rahmer, President of Calista Corporation and the Placer Dome Corporation, and Representative Carl Morgan. This is regarding the Dolan Creek infrastructure issues update, and I'm sure that the two are kind of connected here because they're both development and how we're going to deal with these things with the global change. Pat has put before you some articles that came out in this week's paper also. If you could peruse these as you're watching, it just happened to be that Saturday in the Anchorage Daily News, they had three different articles about global warming and the problem. So it's very poignant, very timely that these articles came out this weekend. And also in the packets, preparing for a change of climate, I know that I believe this was sent out to us before. I did take the time to read through it. It's very interesting and probably go along with what Professor Weller is going to tell us. So to move us on from here, Professor, I'd like to give you the floor, and thank you for the presentation. Oh, one more thing. Professor did say that if we have questions during the half-hour presentation, we'd just as soon take them as we go. So please be notified if you have something, acknowledge the chair, and we'll go through it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm very happy to have the invitation from you to talk about global climate change and some of the impacts here in Alaska, particularly on its resources. But I'm not sure whether it's necessary for me to introduce myself. I'm Gunter Weller. I'm a professor of geophysics. Emeritus, actually, I'm retired at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but I keep my hand in the global climate change business and have done so for the last, I've been at the university for 33 years now. I came from Australia. You wouldn't believe it because my accent is certainly not Australian. but it was for me a bit too late to learn the proper accent when I arrived with my parents as a teenager in Australia. And for the last, last 33 years here, I've been here in Alaska. But my specialty is global climate change, or particularly change in the high latitudes. I've worked for many years in the Antarctic, so I like cold climates and the climate that's associated with these cold climates. And in the last 5 years, I have worked extensively on the impacts of climate change in the high latitudes, particularly Alaska, but also the whole Arctic. What does it mean to the social and to the economic sectors that are affected by global climate change? And I want to talk a little about that. I'll take about half an hour. And as the chair said, please interrupt me by any means, if you have questions or if you want to make comments, fine with me. I have low-tech overheads, and we'll start with those. And as your chair has pointed out, there are all kinds of headlines that have appeared in the paper over the years, some of them pretty dramatic. To some of them, I have contributed myself, as you can see here. But the news always, well, the newspaper people always want bad news, that they make better money than good news. And some of these headlines here may be a little dramatic. Nevertheless, I want to talk about some of the facts of global climate warming first. And then tell you that everything is not as bad as it appears, because there are positive impacts and negative impacts of climate change, and both ought to be considered. Let me start out with a few facts. I'm sure that most of you are aware that the temperature, the global temperature, as shown in this diagram here, in degrees F on the Fahrenheit on the right and centigrade on the left, has changed, although in a wiggly line, from the 1860s, the period of the Industrial Revolution that's taken place over the last 150 years or so. And you can see also the signal is very uneven. There has been a temperature increase of about 1 degree Fahrenheit around the world. You may not think that that is very large, but I'll show you to you in a minute or a little later that this is actually quite a very substantial signal. The cause of this increase is now generally believed to be greenhouse gases, mostly carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is produced when you burn fossil fuels, coal, oil, gas, and so on. And this is the record of the increase of carbon dioxide over the same period, expressed in parts per million. You can see that there's actually very little of that gas in the atmosphere, but it's risen steadily. This is the record that's been collected with instruments here at Mauna Loa, but there's a similar station up at Barrow here in Alaska. There's one at South Pole. There are stations all around the world, and they all show the same thing. And these records are from ice cores. You core or you collect ice from deep in an ice sheet, and the little tiny bubbles in the ice can be analyzed, and you can determine what the carbon dioxide was at the time when they were deposited. So you get a good record here. The little wiggles here are due to the fact that vegetation, of course, takes up carbon dioxide in spring and in summer to make plant material. So in spring, there is a decrease, and in fall, when the plant material decays again, it goes up a little. But overall, you can see the trend. Now, where does this stuff come from? We are concerned here not with the there's a lot of natural carbon dioxide, too, given off by trees and by decaying vegetation. But this is a picture of the carbon dioxide produced by from industrial sources. And you can see that at the present, it's the developed world, the developed nations that have contributed three-quarters of the industrial carbon dioxide, of which the USA is the biggest contributor, followed closely by Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Western Europe is a major contributor, Asia a relatively minor contributor. But in about 30 years' time, the picture will change quite dramatically. China will then become the biggest contributor to carbon dioxide. It has huge coal resources, as you know, and the industrial development of China will undoubtedly lead to a great increase in the emission of carbon dioxide from China, making the U.S. the second most. And you can also see that the part of the developing world becomes much more important. The developed world only contributes about half of the carbon dioxide. Now, this carbon dioxide produces what is called the greenhouse effect, and I will not go into any big technical explanation, but the greenhouse effect is so called because the gas, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, acts like the glass in a greenhouse. The glass in the greenhouse lets in the sunlight. The sunlight gets absorbed at the surface and gets re-radiated, emitted as infrared, as heat radiation, and the glass traps this radiation. The infrared outgoing radiation cannot go through the glass, so you get a heating effect in the greenhouse itself. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere acts in a very similar manner. The more carbon dioxide you have, the bigger the glass becomes, as it were, and the bigger the greenhouse effect. So as we continue to pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it gets warmer and warmer. I should also point out that there are natural sources of greenhouse gases. If the natural greenhouse didn't exist, the temperature of the Earth would be 60 degrees Fahrenheit colder than it is now. In other words, life would probably not exist on this Earth. So what we're talking about when we talk about the greenhouse effect is the additional industrial carbon dioxide on top of the natural greenhouse effect. Just one more picture of explanation before we go into more details. And this is now looking at temperature changes over the last 150,000 years. Here's the time scale, 150,000 years, and this yellow line here is the temperature record, or the change in temperature over the last 150,000 years. This area here is an ice age, you know, the last ice age that lasted about 100,000 years. At the moment, we are in a warm period called an interglacial, and about 120 or 130,000 years ago, there was another warm period, which is also an interglacial. You can see several interesting things here, that the difference between a warm period and a cold and ice age and the present warm period, as you can see here, is only about 5 or 6 degrees centigrade. That's 10 degrees Fahrenheit. The difference between an ice age and a warm period like now is 10 degrees F. So a 1 degree change that we've already observed is a major step towards changing climatic conditions globally very substantially. Yeah. The other interesting thing in this graph is the blue line, and that's the carbon dioxide that's recovered from ice cores. And you can see a perfect correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature. When the carbon dioxide is high, the temperature is high. When the carbon dioxide is low, the temperature is low. Where we are at present is here. This is the highest level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere ever experienced by the Earth. And where we are will be in 100 years is here, if we go on at the present rate. It doesn't take much intelligent deduction to think that the temperature as a consequence will rise. And that's the greenhouse effect that we're concerned about. So unprecedented levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere followed by very substantial rises in temperature. Now, how do we know about these rises? We have the only way to think about future climate is to look at computer models. And the computer models, these so-called GCMs, general circulation models or global climate models, can predict in future what the climate will be like. There are also other factors that are important in climate. For those of you who followed the debate, you know that there are natural forces in climate. There's natural variability, there are volcanic eruptions, there's solar variability, which are also important in climate. It's not only the anthropogenic, the man-made greenhouse effect. And if the models, and these are various model ones in various colors, try to reproduce the natural cycles, you can see that the actual observation, which is the black line, and the models do not coincide. The same appears when you only model the anthropogenic, the man-made greenhouse effects. You can see here that the actual observations do not match what the models can predict. But if you combine the two, then there's a very good match, and then you can with some confidence predict what the climate will be like up to 2100, and that's what the models predict. That we may get temperature increases globally of 10 degrees Fahrenheit, temperature increase, which is an enormous signal, and in the high latitude, maybe, including Alaska, maybe twice that much. So this is the only way we have of looking at the future through these models. Now, what have we observed so far? Here's a picture that is taken from observations, meteorological stations around the Arctic. And what it shows, Circumarctic, here's Alaska, here's Siberia, Greenland, Scandinavia, is that the red areas here have seen a temperature increase. And the green and blue areas have seen a temperature drop. And these are for a period from 1966 to 95, in other words, 30 years, with a change in temperature of 1 degree C, that's about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, per decade for the last 30 years. In other words, in Alaska here, and in parts of Canada here, and in Siberia, the temperature has increased 3 times 1 degree F, or 3 times 2 degrees, 1 degree C, or 2 degrees F, which has been sort of about a 5 degree temperature warming for these regions. You can also see that in some areas here, say Greenland and Labrador and some of Baffin Island, Davis Strait, there has been a cooling. But overall, the Arctic has heated up very substantially. This is in the annual mean. Now, if you look at the winter temperatures, and all of us who live in Alaska here know that the winters are much warmer, you can see this quite clearly too. Again, the red areas are where warming has occurred in winter. And this time, the scale is 2 degrees C, or almost 4 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And since we're talking about 3 decades, we have seen, in other words, a 10 degree Fahrenheit warming in Alaska in these red regions, which is a very substantial warming of most of the Arctic, except, again, this area here. So there's no question that the Arctic has warmed up very much. Am I going too fast, or does anybody have any questions? Please feel free. consequence. Of this warming, snow and ice have melted, of course. This is a picture of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean, including the Bering Sea, the Chukchi Sea, and the Beaufort Sea that are on the western north coasts of Alaska. And you can see from over this period of 50 years, from 45 to 95, a fairly substantial reduction in the extent of sea ice in the ocean. This is in millions of square kilometers, and you can see this from the various investigations, various ways, mostly from satellites looking at the extent of ice, that the sea ice is beginning to disappear, and this will have some consequences, which I'll get to in a minute. We have also seen from other records, I'm sorry, this is a little more complex, but these are records from the upward-looking sonars of U.S. nuclear submarines, which are, of course, cruising under the ice of the Arctic Ocean. You can see here for various oceans or various parts of the Arctic Ocean. Here's the Chukchi Sea, the Beaufort Sea north of Alaska, and the Central Arctic and then the Eastern Arctic, the draft, meaning the thickness of the ice. And in 1958 to 1976, in the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea, in other words, the areas close to Alaska, the sea ice is on the average about 2 meters thick. In the Central Arctic, it's much thicker. It's about 4 meters thick. But lately, from 1993 to 97, again from nuclear submarines looking upward, you have seen a reduction to about 1 meter. The ice around the Alaskan coast is now only 1 meter thick. And in the Central Arctic, it's only about 2 meters thick. In other words, the ice is up only half the thickness that it was several decades ago. And you can see that here also, that the change in draft or in thickness is a meter here around the Alaskan coast, which is very substantial, and almost 2 meters in the Central Arctic. So the warming has caused a reduction in ice. The warming has also caused a change in temperature in the permafrost. This is a picture from an illustration in the vicinity of Fairbanks, but it applies to many other parts in Alaska. The mean annual temperature is shown on this part, and the years on the bottom here. And you can see that for various soil depths, you know, this is in meters, 12 centimeters, this is a foot, this is almost 2 feet, 3 feet, the temperature has been rising very steadily. And you can see also then that if the temperature goes above zero, of course the permafrost melts. And the permafrost melting is a big problem that I'll talk about again in a minute. In fact, if you look at the distribution of permafrost in North America, on the whole North American continent, you know that the blue area here is discontinuous permafrost. You know, it's patchy, it's a few meters thick, it's the kind of stuff you find around Fairbanks or in the interior. Sometimes it's present, sometimes it's absent. If you build a house in it, you have problems, particularly if it's ice-rich. The region is also very close to melting point. It's only about, you know, Fairbanks annual mean temperature is 28, so you only need to raise temperature by 4 degrees, and the permafrost is beginning to thaw. And the projection here is that if you increase the temperature by this amount, and this will occur when you double the atmospheric CO2, which will occur within 80 or 100 years, all of this permafrost will melt, will go away. Now, to some people, this may be very good news, because permafrost is obviously a problem when it comes to road constructions or housing constructions or what have you. But while it melts, problems occur because, you know, roads collapse and houses collapse and pipelines have to be re-engineered. So we have a problem here with thawing of permafrost. What happens when permafrost thaws? I'm sorry for these relatively poor pictures, but in the boreal forest, which is underlain by permafrost, the trees collapse. And over a period of a few decades, the boreal forest turns first into wetlands. And we are beginning to see that throughout Alaska. And eventually, when the wetlands dry out, into grasslands, into steppe type, you know, grassland vegetation. So there is a transformation from one ecosystem to another ecosystem within a relatively short time scale. In Russia, you have the same problem. You see these huge slumps that occur in permafrost terrain, and obviously this is a problem when you have man-made infrastructure in the area. Here's a picture that fortunately is not from Alaska, it's from Russia. And this not only reflects perhaps partly somewhat inferior Russian building techniques, but also the fact that many of these cities in the far north are built on permafrost. They are sitting on piles that are driven into the permafrost. The piles are not deep enough. As the permafrost begins to thaw, the strength of the soil that supports the piles is no longer adequate, and this happens. And this is happening. This were pictures supplied to us by Russian engineers. And this is a picture that you see, and, you know, it affects everything from power plants to nuclear power stations to houses to everything. So this is clearly a problem that has to be figured into impacts when you talk about permafrost melting. One of our Russian colleagues, an engineer from Moscow, came up with these interesting statistics, which need a little explanation. So there are three cities, Orkuta, Tiksi, and Yakutsk, three big Russian cities, which mostly consist of these four- or five-story apartment buildings where most people live, if you've traveled in that part of the world. This is the year of construction, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and this is the year of failure, you know, when the houses will collapse. And this engineer who gave us these statistics showed us that in 30 years' time in Yakutsk, not a single one of these buildings will survive. They will all collapse, 100% failure. I think, which is a pretty frightening statistic for the people who have to take care of housing and keeping these houses either artificially frozen or, and he said this is a very expensive proposition that they cannot afford in Russia, so they have a real serious problem.
Excuse me.
Yes?
There looks like about a fourfold increase between...
Sorry.
Yes. Between the 1990 and 2000. Is that actual data or is that all projection?
This is projection, of course. This is projecting a temperature that increases at the rate shown by the models.
What I'm wondering, did you experience that kind of an increase, say in Yakutsk, that four,
yes.
Sixfold, it's actually up
yes.
that much?
Yes. But it'll take a little longer in order to get to the temperature where all it's you know, this is a projection to 2030. Yeah, but the observations bear out the projections. And in some other cities, you know, Yakutsk is in real cold permafrost terrain, so the problems are pretty severe here. Tiksi is up on the Arctic coast; it's also pretty bad. Orkuta is more towards Europe, the European Arctic is a little warmer. So the temperature increase is not as drastic there. But anyway, it's a big problem. Okay, glaciers. We also know that from observations that glaciers are melting, of course, as the temperature increases. You see that in glaciers like, I don't think this is the Columbia, but this is similar to the Columbia Glacier, but a whole series of glaciers here in North America, some in Alaska, Galkana Glacier, Lemon Creek here on the Juneau Ice Field, McCall in the Brooks Range, and Worthington, slightly positive. But you see, most of them show a loss of ice, expressed here in tens of meters. So here, this is 100 foot of ice that has disappeared from these glaciers at this level here. See, and many of them have lost about 30 feet of ice, have gone down by 30 feet. Also, the terminus, you know, the snout of a glacier has recessed. So there are effects on glaciers. And what this does, of course, let me just show another example here. This is the Muir Glacier, which is not far from here, which has, like most of the tidewater glaciers here in Alaska, have gone back very substantially, as the Columbia is doing now. Now, in 1941, the Muir Glacier was out here, 50, 58, and so on and so forth, until now it's around here. So it has lost a huge mass of ice. Partly due, not totally to, I should explain, but partly due to climate warming. You know. When glaciers melt, sea level rises. And I'm sorry, I don't have a picture for Alaska, because I think you could probably draw a similar picture, particularly for the Yukon Delta, which is very low-lying area. But if you have a sea level rise of one meter, which is pretty substantial, I have to admit, you know, it's not that we're expecting a 1 meter of sea level rise within 100 years. It could take several hundred years. But eventually, if a 1 meter sea level rise occurs, the Everglades go, the Keys go, all the barrier islands around Florida go, It's a major impact on ports and facilities and coastal, and since many people, in fact, the majority of the human population lives in coastal areas, this will undoubtedly be an impact. There will be an impact in Alaska also, as I said, in the Yukon Delta, in Poudre Bay, which is not all that high, in other areas where there is a low, well, there's low land. Well, you know, even the Tananarive Classic, the Ice Classic, has shown dates of breakup that are much later now, are much earlier now than they were in the past. Permafrost temperatures have increased slowly over the years. So, you know, here again you begin to see the thawing. There is an earlier breakup of snow at Barrow. All the signals are very consistent. It's warmer, there's less sea ice, permafrost is thawing, glaciers are melting, there's less river and lake ice. The whole physical environment has changed very dramatically. Okay, so much for the background. Now I really need a quick speed up and show you a very complex table that you have in your handout, in that colored handout, that is beginning to show impacts. Now let me skip that. And go straight to, so what does it all mean now? And particularly, what does it mean in terms of impacts on the resources that your committee is concerned with? I have an explanation of symbols here. If it's plus, and I cannot put precise dollar values on it, but if it's plus, it's good for the Alaska economy. If it's double plus, it's very good. If it's minus, it's bad. And if it's double minus, it's very bad. We have reached a stage now where we're talking with economists in order to really put dollar values on what these pluses and minuses really mean. But that's a very difficult undertaking. Let's start with non-renewable resources, oil and gas. Well, clearly, exploration, particularly in offshore areas, will benefit if there's less sea ice. You know, the rigs that have to be constructed on the North Slope of Alaska in the offshore areas now are very expensive because they have to stand up to very strong ice pressure, very strong ice forces. If there's less ice, clearly it will be very beneficial. And I have two columns here, you know, one on the short-term impacts and one on the long-term impacts. In the long run, the less ice we have, the better it'll be for offshore exploration. No question. On the other hand, offshore exploration also relies fairly strongly on ice roads up on the up along the Beaufort Coast in the Poudre Bay area. With a much warmer climate, there will be an impact, not as big as the impact on rigs, but nevertheless, ice roads will be more difficult to construct. So that's a negative, slight negative. So far we've talked about exploration. Now production, there are likely to be problems with coastal facilities. As the sea ice recedes, you have a bigger fetch area, you get stronger storm surges. Storm surges are already a big problem along much of the Alaskan coast. You know, look at villages like Shishmaref or Kibalina, where they have had huge erosion problems, where they're talking about relocating entire villages. Clearly, this will also affect the oil fields and the artificial islands that are being constructed, and a lot of them have been constructed on the Canadian part, too, in the Mackenzie Delta, where sea level rise and strong storm surges could be a really serious problem in the long run. So that's a negative. On transportation, again, we are talking about positives, because the less sea ice and river ice there is, the easier it will be to put ships into ports and let them go through the ice. And this will be a very positive impact in the long run. Pipeline problems, you know, thawing permafrost. As you know, half of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system is above ground and is kept artificially frozen through these vertical support members and an eddy of freezing fluid in the system that keeps them refrigerated. This is not a problem that cannot be engineered around, but as the permafrost thaws, the problem will be the same as with the Siberian houses, and some of the pipeline would have to be re-engineered. And this will certainly cost money. I don't know how much, but there will be some impact. Let's talk about other non-renewable resources.
How about highway systems? Did you
highway systems, same thing. You know, the whole infrastructure, the production, I actually didn't point that out. the transportation system on highways and on air and airfields will also be negatively impacted. Didn't they re-engineer the Deadhouse airfield a few years ago at pretty substantial cost because of permafrost problems? So that's a problem. Same with highways. Highway maintenance, highway, not construction, but maintenance is already a big problem in permafrost terrain. And I think about 25% or 30% of paved highways in Alaska are underlain by permafrost. If you drive up the highway, Richardson Highway from Valdez to Fairbanks at Sourdough, the thing looks like a real roller coaster, as you know. And that's a problem that will only get worse if the temperature increases. Production for minerals and coal, probably not a big problem, except in the transportation systems, again, in infrastructure, you know, roads and infrastructure, thawing permafrost is a slight negative. So that has to be considered. So these are in non-renewable resources. Are there renewable resources? Now we're talking briefly about the renewable resources. And again, the same system, starting with fish. Fisheries is, after all, a big economic sector in Alaska. As temperatures change and ocean conditions changes, including salinity and what have you, since fish respond very sensitively to change, there will be positive and negative impacts, some good in some areas, bad in other areas. And they will only be exacerbated if the conditions continue like this. Harvesting may be a little more difficult. You know, fisheries in stormier weather is likely to be a negative. The possibility, if there's whole relocation of fisheries, may mean relocating fish processing plants, you know, from Kodiak or from Dutch Harbor to other places, and that's unknown, but may cost money. Timber resources, not a big part of the Alaskan economy, but nevertheless a part of it. As the climate continues to warm, as it gets warmer, there's more carbon dioxide, there's warmer temperatures, the trees will grow. It'll be good for timber. On the other hand, we have also observed that there is a more frequent fire season, a longer fire season, and there are these insect outbreaks like the spruce bark beetles, which are a real problem in southeast. So there could be the negative impacts. So timber will be affected both positively and negatively. Agriculture, positive. You know, we've already seen a 20% increase in the growing season, so that's obviously positive. Then we talk about water, which is also a big resource. In some of the other parts of the nation, of course, is much more important. We have plenty of water. But hydropower, will there be less, say, for example, with melting glaciers, you lose the reservoir that is available in summer to replenish reservoirs. So that's a negative impact. There are a number of uncertainties that have still not been determined. Power lines, extreme weather, storms, permafrost thaw on the pylons themselves, probably a negative impact. And finally, but not least, last but not least, certainly the impact on wildlife. Native subsistence will certainly be affected because as the sea ice disappears, the marine mammals like walrus or seals, or maybe even whales, whales that to some extent depend on the ice will be impacted. If there is no ice, they will migrate somewhere else. And then on land, what will snow cover do to moose or caribou? Still largely unknown. But you can see overall that there is likely to be impacts that should be taken seriously. Just to illustrate one impact on fisheries, this is not from Alaska, this is Atlantic cod actually, but you can see the red here is temperature, and the green is fish catches. And the warmer it is, the more fish there are, the more are caught. It's a very clear correlation. Unless and until the fishery is depleted, you know, there are no longer any Arctic cod, any North Atlantic cod, and it doesn't matter what the temperature is. But this is an example that fish respond very sensitively to temperature and ocean conditions, and therefore we can expect some impacts on fisheries too. I've given you a very quick and I hope not too long, outline of some of the problems we see. You can see that there are positive and negative impacts. We have not been able to quantify them fully yet in terms of dollars, but I think we should take some of this stuff seriously. There's no need to panic. There's a need to look at this intelligently and think what kind of strategies we might want to put into place in order to meet some of these challenges, because challenges they will be, and we better be prepared for them. So I'll close here and ask whether you have any questions or comments. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, this was extremely informative, and I really thank you for taking the time to come to us. I'm wondering how long you have been putting this together, and here's the reason I asked the question. I belong to an organization that is nationwide, and this, about 5 or 6 years ago, for a 2 or 3 year period, he decided that there was a raging argument among two different types of researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Those who said, no, it's not, it's a cycle, and those who said, no, it's going up. And I'm wondering, have you, A, been in touch with that type of academia? And if so, yours seems to be irrefutable, and theirs was kind of questionable. Why is yours so much more irrefutable?
Well, controversy has existed for some years. But as we begin to collect data, as we begin to improve our numerical models, we are becoming much more confident that what I have said here is really what we believe will happen. The refinement of this picture has occurred over many years, but it's now culminated in an international effort called the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change. These are experts, climate experts, modeling experts, experts from many different fields that have come together to make a pronouncement where we stand on this question. And I think there is no longer a controversy about the effect of the greenhouse on the climate. If there's any controversy, and there are always some people who are still doubting, it is about the magnitude and the exact timing. But the majority of the scientific opinion is behind these kind of scenarios I presented here, and really believe that this is what we should look for. And again, we should not panic. We should look at this carefully and see what we can do. And the next few years or decades will bear out whether we are right or not, but we think we will be right.
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. One of your slides, very interesting slide, showing the polar cap and showed some warming and cooling areas. And if I'm not mistaken, on the edges, which I would assume were several degrees of latitude lower, on either side looked like a coulee.
Yes.
Is this significant? And you showed some pretty significant rises in temperature.
Yes.
Is that global, or is that just primarily in the northern hemisphere, or maybe even in the ice cap, and that there are offsetting cooling areas in other parts of the world?
The picture I showed you at the beginning was the global trend, and that's 1 degree F. That, you know, 1 degree Fahrenheit for the global temperature increase over the last 100 years. But you're right, there are some areas where there's a little cooling. Overall, we can definitely say there has been a warming, but in some areas there is a cooling, and this has to do with the global circulation, you know, with the winds that bring warm air north and cold air south. And in some of these areas, a pattern has been established in the Arctic that brings cold air. I should almost show you the diagram again. Brings cold air south. Allow me to show this quickly. This picture here, one of the reasons why Alaska is so warm is that the jet stream, which circles the globe here and brings in the weather and the warmer and lower temperatures, has been more in a southerly direction, bringing lots of warm air into Alaska. But then as it curves south again, it brings cold air into this part of the Arctic. Then it swings north again, and it's warm, and then it brings south again, and it's a little cooler. But overall, as you can see, the warming has been established, and it certainly overrides the area of cooling, but it's patchy. It's not a simple picture. Nothing in climate, unfortunately, is very simple. You know, it's all there are many complex parameters, but that's the explanation.
Antarctica is doing the same thing, or is it
very simple? Antarctica hasn't seen such a big warming as the Arctic. It's not as strong.
I don't want to monopolize the question.
Representative Stevens.
Dr. Rollin, we've been hearing a lot in the area of fisheries about what they call a regime shift.
Yes.
And it seems to me like if the biologists could somehow overlay what's happened in these regime shifts over time, that they might correlate quite well with what you're finding. And where sometimes we maybe beat ourselves up over overfishing, and then scientists say, well, maybe it's not that. Maybe that's not the problem of overfishing. Maybe it's just this regime shift. We go from one species to another, or the species move. So is anyone doing that type of connection with the work you're doing?
Yes,
maybe from fisheries.
Yeah, but it's very, you know, if you talk about biology and any biota, there are so many factors that affect, say, a fish population. Not just climate, it's overfishing, it's gear use, it's economic factors. It's a very difficult thing to sort out. But these regime shifts have definitely occurred and associated with...
...which shows deposit across inlet from Anchorage. Our worldwide focus for more than a decade has been clearly focused on gold. As most of you are aware, the gold prices continue to hover at record low levels. This low-price environment has caused major gold mining companies to focus their financial resources on optimizing their existing mining operations. One of the consequences of this effort has been that worldwide exploration budgets over the past few years have been significantly reduced. The Donlin Creek Exploration Project is a case in point. The project is severely challenged by this low-price environment. I think last week it was still around $260 an ounce. The project continues to be de-emphasized by Placer Dome as a result. Our ongoing economic evaluations indicate that even at a higher gold price, the project would still be challenged by the lack of affordable power in the region, and by the remoteness of the project site. Nonetheless, Placer Dome continues to view Alaska as a favorable place for our business due to the geologic potential, the evolving regulatory and business climate, and the support we've received from the administration and the bipartisan support we've had with the Alaska legislature, most notably Carl Morgan and Representative Mary Kapsner, who's also toured our site with her son Conrad last year, I guess. And what we can see is that mines are being discovered, permitted, and built in Alaska. And for the U.S. mining industry, it is one of the bright spots we see in this country. And the industry's attention and Placer Dome's attention does remain in Alaska. The commitments we have with our partners in the Donlin Creek Project, the Calista Corporation and the Kuskokwim Corporation, are ongoing. We continue to provide support to the two Calista in their efforts, which we reviewed in this session as well, to address the regional infrastructure issues, which can play an important role for Donlin Creek, as well as other future mineral discoveries in the region. My co-presenter today from Placer Dome is Mr. Bill Bieber. Bill will provide an update on the Donlin Creek Gold Exploration Project. Bill has more than 20 years of experience in the mining industry with Placer Dome. He's been involved in our mining operations, in human resources, and in safety efforts in our U.S. mines. Since 1996, he has been assistant project director at Donlin Creek, focusing on our shareholder hire efforts and all of the operations at the project site. I'll turn it over to Bill.
Okay, thank you, Stan. Good afternoon, committee members. I have some handouts here. And you kind of follow along with the program. Is it okay if I stand? Okay. To start with, like Stan and Mr. Morgan and Mr. Romer mentioned, the project is quite remote. The nearest road is somewhere around 300 miles away. Everything to and from the project is all flown in. Our involvement with the project began in 1995, where we entered into an agreement with Calista Corporation and the Kuskokwim Corporation. The Calista Corporation manages the mineral rights portion of the agreement, and the Kuskokwim Corporation manages the surface rights. In 1995, we came in with a relatively small program, 20 employees, drilled some holes. The results were showed enough encouragement for us to continue. In 1996, we built a 75-person year-round camp, constructed 12 miles of road, constructed a 5,000-foot airstrip. In 1996, we spent around $15 million. From that point to today, we've drilled about 290,000 feet of core, 36,000 feet of trenching, a lot of geophysical work, a lot of geophysical mapping and trenching for geology. We've also maintained 4 years of continuous environmental baseline studies, fish studies, things like that. We also came up with a geological resource, and that resource was estimated at 12 half of this or less. Okay, the rest is what we call inferred. We'd need more further drilling, tighter space drilling to bring those into measured and indicated. Economic studies show continual improvement, and I'll take you through some of the slides there that indicate how it's progressed, you know, from there. Year to date, we've spent about $33 million on the project. One of the programs that was laid out in the early days of 1995 when the agreements were signed between Calista and Placer Dome was a program called the Shareholder Hire Program. And basically what that does is it's an agreement between us that we will employ locally, local shareholders, for the project. And one of the stipulations, or I guess one of the only stipulations, is that a shareholder or spouse of a shareholder will be first considered for employment if training can be accomplished in a reasonable amount of time. Approximately 52% of our workforce from 1995 to date has consisted of a shareholder workforce. Not only that, we try to focus that employment close to the project, meaning that, you know, generally within the Kuskokwim Corporation areas or, you know, thereabouts. Also, we've spent a lot of time and commitment out into the villages and talking to the elders council. We solicited their input in a lot of our project, our programs for the project. We also tried to familiarize ourselves with the local cultures because it's very important that we're all on the same page when we're trying to develop workforces. We also contribute $20,000 annually to scholarship funds. At least twice a year, we try to visit all of the local village elders and update them on the projects and where we're at and where we're hoping to go. Some of the results, I put some of these results in here of how the program has progressed. In 1995, we employed 20 employees, 96, 172 employees, and so on. I also, and you have these handouts, but one of the things I really wanted to point out with the success of the program is our drug and alcohol testing results. Now, it may not be appropriate to have in categories like this, but one thing that it does state is that not just the project isn't just there or providing a monetary value to the region, but it's also providing a social value. And one of the key indicators here is in 1995, we didn't keep any records, but in 96, we had a 90% pre-employment drug fail rate. And we instituted a very strict drug and alcohol policy consisting of random testing and the whole nine yards. And we're pretty proud of this today. We have a 0% fail rate. Also, the turnover rate. When you come over to here, the employee turnover rate in 1996 was 310%, and over the last couple of years, it's been almost zero. What that's telling us as a company is that, yes, we can develop a stable and productive workforce in the region utilizing local hire. And like I mentioned, those are also included in the handout. Should everything go well and we go into a mine development phase, and Stan's going to talk to you a little bit later on about we're not a mine, we're just in exploration, but it would be a large open pit mine. It would employ nearly 600 employees. Now, studies have indicated to us that for every one job that we would provide, there would probably be three or four collateral jobs associated with that. Assuming that power could be delivered to site for around 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Operating costs, and here's one of our hurdles in our project, not just the fact that it's remote, but the fact that the ore we're dealing with is refractory, therefore requires a specialized milling process. Therefore, the average or the milling costs are 5 to 6 times higher for this project than they would be for conventional milling. Our capital cost to construct the mine would be $740 million, and the project is not viable, obviously, today at today's gold prices. When we put this together, it was $275, and I think it's like $260 today. But just to give you some idea of what the project is looking at.
Do you take questions now, or would you rather wait?
Sure.
On that last slide, you said 4.5 cents per kW. Is that, this is going to be an energy-intensive operation.
It's very energy-intensive.
What sort of, how does that relate with dollars per ton, or do you have that, if you can't get power, say, less than 7 or 8 cents?
Okay, we've determined that we can probably generate power on site ourselves at a cost of between 4.5 and 7 cents if we could. Okay, if we could get the 30 million gallons of fuel to the project, if we could, you know. So that's the figure that that's basing all the rest of this on.
Okay, that's not assuming that you can find local power. You're actually still bringing fuel oil in and generating.
That we had to come up with a number.
Okay.
And whether this is legitimate or not, this is kind of a,
okay.
And also keeping in mind that we have not yet completed a feasibility study, those would be things we would iron out through that process. But we had to supply a number in order to come up with some results.
I believe the concept is that power can be delivered to the project at that cost to the gate, whether we were cruising or not. Accurate comment.
And the mine would require at least 50 megawatts. Just to give you an idea of how the resources progressed through the years, one other thing to keep in mind, when we started into this project in 1996, we were using $425 gold as a factor. So throughout the years, as we built up the resource, it actually became worth a lot less. Stan's going to talk to you a little bit about the NPVs of the project. Do you want to answer questions now?
Well, why don't we get through this slide and then take questions at the end or at the end of this graph shows, just a bar graph showing the progress of our engineering and economic evaluations as they pertain to the project. And you see in the early years, 96, 97, 98, here again, going by the color code at the base of the slide, assuming a gold price of $375 per ounce and interest rate 5%, net present value is in the negative category. It clearly doesn't meet any of our economic hurdles. As we progressed, the gold price did decrease. We assumed a slightly higher interest rate through our financing estimates. And you can see that from 99 to 2000 and in September 2000, where our last update occurred, at a $350 gold price, here again, by increasing the throughput, going to the larger scale operation, sharpening the pencil and assuming a lower cost power source could be identified and provided to the operation, we started to see positive cash flows, positive net present value. However, the reality of the situation is with a $275 gold price, you can see the red bar just clearly does not clear the hurdle. Close to clearing the hurdle. We need a significantly higher price. And even at a $350 gold price, we would still need to see an affordable power source and an assumption that there would be a viable transportation system for access to the deposit. Currently, the river system, we're talking to Alaska-based companies about transportation using the river system. It is possible, but we have a lot of concerns about shipping 30 million gallons of diesel fuel commodities up the river. It is doable. There are risks involved, and this is much of risk tolerance. One thing in all of our efforts and in all our discussions with Calista and the elders and people of the region, we've grown to respect the tremendous amount of environmental protection that this type of project would need, and that we would have to ensure that the fish and game resources of the region, especially the salmon in the rivers, could be protected. And all our efforts are geared towards assuring that, and that is one of the question marks about using the river as the sole source of transportation.
Just one quick one, and Stan, you may not want to answer this, but let's just really get into an optimistic mode, and the price would get back up in the 350 range. What would it take to say, well, yes, this pencils out, if assuming you get low-cost power, but what if 4 or 5 years into the project it drops back down around 300 or 290 or something?
Well, gold is one of those commodities that could do that. I think what we want to see, it's not a question of that $350 gold price, a switch is pushed and the project goes into a feasibility study mode. It would have to be a gold price environment that we would view as sustainable for the mine life, which is forecast to be, say, 10 to 20 years. And in the natural resource commodity business, that's a difficult forecast to make.
No, no, I just thanking you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You answered one about the life of it. Have you done any further exploration, to find out whether there's any further reserves?
Yes, we have. And it's ongoing. We're still even, we'll even probably do some exploration. But what the indicators to us are thus far is the only way we could change this economic picture would be to find higher grade in a localized area. But, right. And all of our early indications say no. So therefore, more of the same would not help us any in the situation. Although we will continue to do exploration.
Thank you. Did that conclude?
That's our portion.
Oh, I'd like to just finish up by saying that, even though, the numbers aren't right today, the resource is there, and it's going to be there for a long time. Whether Placer has anything to do with it, somebody probably will eventually. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard introduced me. I'm Frank Bettine. I'm an engineer and attorney. I've been working as an engineer in Alaska since about 1978 when I came up here and started working for a gentleman by the name of Bob Rutherford. I don't know how many of you still remember him. And he got bought out by International Engineering Company, and so I worked with him for a while. And I went over to Chugach Electric and worked as a substation engineer and transmission line designer for them for a while, and then migrated up to Glen Allen, where I worked as the manager of engineering for about 3 or 4 years. And in 1989, my wife said, why don't we go back to law school? And I said, sure, why not? And so we went back to the University of Idaho and got our law degree and came up here and opened up our law firm. But I've been doing work for Calista as an engineer slash attorney, helping them with some of their studies since about 1992, I guess. So I was very honored when they came to me and asked me to assist them in doing this regional energy needs study for the region. That study is ongoing. It's still under preparation. I hope to have a draft out in about 4 months. And the study's being prepared to its nonprofit. I call it subsidiary. You really can't have a nonprofit subsidiary, but I use that term. New Vista Light and Power, this was an organization that Richard did mention. I helped them form that organization or that company about 3 or 4 years ago because the whole purpose of that company is to look at alternatives for lowering the cost of power to the villages in the Calista region. I'd like to point out that this is a conceptual level study, meaning that we're using approximations here to come up with the cost of power, so approximating cost of plant construction. When you look at, say, a coal plant, we're estimating the cost is $750 a kilowatt install, or using average cost for construction transmission lines that we've obtained from other sources in the state. So it's not a real detailed study, but all of the various alternatives that we're looking at are being compared using those same numbers. The purpose of the study was to identify regional electric power and energy needs, or the purpose of the study is energy requirements both with and without the Donlin Creek Gold Mine project. Once we've identified those various requirements, then we need to identify the least cost power supply alternatives to provide that power. And then, lastly, determine if it's feasible for this New Vista Light and Power organization to provide the power to Donlin Creek Mine. And if feasible, how would that benefit the region as a whole, Solicitor Region? Well, I'm not here to talk to you about looking at power for the 55-some-odd villages in the Solicitor Region today. I'm basically here to concentrate on the work I've done on the evaluation of the power supply alternatives for Donlin Creek Mine. And I'll tell you how that interfaces with supplying lower-cost power throughout the region. First, we had to identify the alternatives that could provide power to the mine. I think Mr. Bill Beaver indicated about 50 megawatts. I believe the size of the mine project has been upgraded, and right now they're looking at about 65 megawatts of power at the mine site, which is a chunk of power. Then we need to evaluate the alternatives that could provide that kind of power to the mine. And then lastly, we recommend an alternative for further evaluation. Now, I sort of looked at alternatives in two general categories. There's two ways to provide power to the mine. One is that we can build transmission lines and import power from the rail belt. The other is we construct new power plants or a new power plant out in the Chalista region, and we provide power to the mine site from that location. Versus power from the rail belt. This is bringing in transmission lines from the rail belt. There are two possible ways to get power there. One is we can purchase power from a Chugach Electric Association and build transmission lines out from the vicinity of their Beluga power plant. The other is to purchase power from Golden Valley Electric and build transmission lines from the vicinity of Nenana. Oops, wrong way. As far as constructing power plants in the Chalista region, we looked at building a large power plant at Bethel, plus 175. 175-